I'm delighted to welcome to the Radio Cafe Marina Whitman. She is professor of business administration and public policy at the University of Michigan, and she's author of the memoir, The Martian's Daughter. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here, Mary Charlotte.
So you are the daughter of John von Neumann, who's the great mathematician and physicist who worked, among other things, on the Manhattan Project. And I found it interesting that in your memoir, you write about the fact that his earlier work was pure mathematics, pure physics, and then later it was more practical and applied, and this reflected shifts in his life and in world events.
That's absolutely right. His work in pure mathematics, which, as you say, was the first part of his career, was done in Europe. He was Hungarian and he taught in Germany. And in the early days, after he came to the United States and became one of the founding members of the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton. But then as the world outlook darkened and Hitler took over in Germany, and my father was one of the early great pessimists about the future of Europe and the fact that if civilization in his term survived, it would be in the New World, in the United States. And as the United States got drawn closer and closer to war and then ultimately entered the war, he became a passionate supporter of the success of the Allies in World War II. And that drew his interests into the practical world. And it was then that he got involved in the Manhattan Project and in anti-ballistic missiles. And his first interest in computers came through his connection with the Army's so-called Aberdeen Proving Ground in Maryland. And actually, what they did was develop firing tables for guns. But these required enormous amounts of computation. And so the Army was very interested in developing computers because the amount of calculation was just enormous. And through more or less chance meeting with a young colonel who was also a mathematician, a man named Hermann Goldstein, my father got interested in the work that was being done at the Aberdeen Proving Ground. And from there, he got involved in the development of better and faster computers. And of course, then when he became involved in the Manhattan Project and building the atomic bomb, it turned out that, again, the calculations required were so enormous that it really would require something a whole lot faster than an old-fashioned adding machine to get the work done. So a lot of his work, his later work on computers and on ABMs, anti-ballistic missiles, and so forth, stemmed from his passionate commitment to the side of the Allies in World War II. Now, his work on game theory was a little bit of a sideline. He had actually invented the foundations of game theory back in the 1930s, but had then sort of left it lying around. And it wasn't until just about the end of the 30s, the beginning of the 40s, that he collaborated with an economist, Oscar Morgenstern, because they thought that the basic principles of economics essentially were nonsense, and that you needed an approach which took into account the fact that individual behavior was responsive to how other people behaved. Although ironically, game theory didn't begin to penetrate economics much for a couple of decades. It very much penetrated military thinking and became central at the Rand Corporation, which had lots of work with the military. And he became very much a part of the famous military-industrial complex. And because he was so busy and then first with wartime activities, and then with building a so-called stored program computer, the modern computer. That really occupied him until the early 50s. And then, of course, he died very, very young. He, by 1955, he was ill, and he died in 57. So I have no idea whether he would have gone back to pure mathematics or not, but he really didn't have time.
Why do you call yourself the Martian's daughter? That's the name of your memoir.
Ah, yes, there is a story behind that. The story goes, and actually I had it confirmed today by somebody who said he knows who the person was who started this story or made the first comment. And the story is that while a bunch of the people working on the Manhattan Project were sitting around on top of the hill, Los Alamos, drinking beer and swapping stories, because there wasn't a whole lot to do if you didn't have a partner and you weren't allowed, you were very restricted in leaving the hill. And one of them said, you know, how is it that so many of the geniuses working on this project are from this little country nobody can even find on a map called Hungary? As somebody else said, and I've been told that the somebody else was actually a physicist named Phil Morrison, said, aha, the truth is these guys are not really human beings at all. They're Martians. But in order to conceal the fact that they're not human beings, they all speak Hungarian, which is a language nobody understands. And then this notion of the Martians, who are five specific Hungarian scientists, all of whom came to the United States and were involved in the Allied effort. The story kind of went viral, and books have been written on the Martians. And so when I was hunting around for a title, it seemed to me that I was the Martian's daughter.
There's wonderful experiences of both of your parents and descriptions of their personalities and their parties and their terrible driving and their throwing the dishes out the window when they didn't want to wash them. And you grew up, I mean, you were in Princeton with Albert Einstein and Carl Gödel in the corner of the living room talking, and Arthur Koestler and many of the other intellectuals of that time were around the dining table with you. What was that like for you at the time, and how do you see it now in retrospect?
Well, at the time, I was unimpressed. I was a teenager. All these fabulous people were sitting around the dinner table, and all I could think about was, are they ever going to get this dinner over with so that I can go upstairs and do my homework and talk on the phone with my friends? Of course, looking back, I realized that listening to these people at an early age was an enormous intellectual stimulus and also gave me into an insight into the cosmopolitanism of the world, so that it is no coincidence that I became an international economist and studied the relations among nations. But I certainly didn't fully appreciate it at the time. And I don't think I fully appreciated it until later. I mean, I knew my father was very smart, and I knew that he was deeply involved in the war effort at a very high level. But I think it only gradually dawned on me, probably starting when I went off to Harvard College, on what a truly remarkable person he was.
And he adored you, and
yes,
he admired you, and expected a great deal of you. What did he expect? Did he want you to go into his field?
He didn't care at all what field I went into, but he cared terribly, and he felt it was really a moral obligation that I use whatever intellectual abilities I had to their fullest. And he didn't care that I was a girl and not a boy. And, you know, this was just an obligation. And when I made it clear to him that I intended to get married right after college to Bob Whitman, who after 57 years remains my husband and turned out to be enormously supportive of my career. But my father was devastated because he thought, and remember this was the 1950s, that any woman who married young would end up mired in domesticity and would not have an opportunity to pursue an intellectual and professional life of her own. So he was deeply upset, and I adored him, and he was dying of cancer. So it was no small thing to say to him, look, I really am going to go ahead with this. And once he realized it was inevitable, he became absolutely gracious. And by the way, he liked Bob. That wasn't the point. The point was that marrying early threatened what he hoped I could become. And as I say, statistically, he was absolutely right. And the result is that throughout my entire career, every time I've, you know, pioneered something or broken some new barrier, I've really had this burning desire to be able to say to him, look, you see, I defied you by doing what I wanted, but in fact, I've also done what you wanted as well.
And you had the advantage of having a remarkable and very unusual husband who not only was supportive of your career during this 1950s time of housewifeliness and all of that, but was willing to move with you and follow your career when it was necessary.
That's right. I mean, we started out quite conventionally where I was the trailing spouse, and when he went from one university to another, I went along and saw what kind of job I could pick up in the new place, and I was always very lucky. And then gradually, things sort of shifted in the sense, well, for a while, after our children had grown up and left home, we started commuting. And Bob did most of the commuting when I took a job with General Motors. And at first, I was with GM in New York, and we lived in Princeton, and he commuted to Pittsburgh. He would go Tuesday mornings and come back Thursday nights. And then later, when I was promoted and had to move to Detroit, well, we live in Ann Arbor, which is a suburb of Detroit. Again, right up until he retired, he commuted, again, with this same sort of three-day week. And so, and again, I'm not sure I could tell you exactly when it happened, but certainly there was this shift in who took the lead in where we lived. Now, as long as our kids were home, we certainly would not have embarked on commuting marriage. And as a matter of fact, when I was asked to be on the Council of Economic Advisors, we had both just had sabbaticals. When I was on the staff of the council and Bob had a sabbatical and did research in Washington. So while the university would certainly give me leave because this was a prestigious appointment, Bob had a bigger problem, particularly since he was chairman of the English department, and that's not a job you can do at a distance. So I was fully prepared to turn it down, although it was a job I passionately wanted and was perfectly suited to my skills and my interests. And we had tried to come up with some solution, and we hadn't. And so this was a Friday, and I said, okay, on Monday I'll call him and say I can't take the job. Well, Friday afternoon, Bob had a meeting of the English department, and there was one particular professor who was a real contrarian and went out of his way to disrupt meetings and make life generally difficult.
And as you described him, was smelly and poorly dressed and had bad teeth and greasy hair.
Exactly. On top of everything. And a personality match. And I still remember Bob coming home from that meeting, which apparently this guy had totally disrupted, and said, the heck with the chairmanship. Let's go to Washington. And it was because of that totally serendipitous event that my career took off in a way which I don't know what would have happened, but I can't imagine it having taken off in exactly the same way if I hadn't gone to the Council of Economic Advisors.
We're talking to Marina Wittman about her memoir, The Martian's Daughter. You had an extraordinary mother who was endlessly energetic and confident and competent, and during World War II, when there were all these Rosie the Riveters out there, she was working and she was taking charge and she was breaking barriers of gender and race and making sure that African Americans were employed even when nobody else wanted them. She made sure that
That's
they were.
Right.
And you had really great role models on both sides. Then you went to Harvard. We're stepping back a few steps and really were very successful there, despite the barriers and the divisions, which I think don't exist at all anymore, between Harvard and Radcliffe. You were in Radcliffe.
Radcliffe, that's right. And it's interesting because academically, there were no divisions. That is, we sat in the same classes with our Harvard classmates. We were graded on the same curves or whatever. We interacted with the same professors. But in our living arrangements and many of our extracurricular activities, we were very much separated. The Radcliffe campus was between 1 and 2 miles from the Harvard houses. Women were not allowed into the Harvard undergraduate library because we might distract the boys. It was while I was at Radcliffe that women were finally allowed to work on the Harvard Crimson. So that there were a lot of things which we would now see as ridiculously isolating. Interestingly enough, it was not something that we worried a whole lot about at the time. I think because what we did have access to was so rich and exciting, we somehow, and looking back, I'm really surprised, we never protested these things. And of course, then in the 60s, not too long after I left, everything changed.
Right.
And the women did start to protest, and gradually, somewhat reluctantly, Harvard changed. And now, of course, at least explicitly, there are no barriers. What more subtle barriers exist, I have no idea, because although I interview for Harvard, I was on the Harvard Board of Overseers, but even that was by now 30 years ago.
Right.
So, but when I talk to young people, young women at Harvard, I don't get the sense that they face anything like, in fact, they wouldn't tolerate the kind of restrictions that we did.
Well, not only restrictions, but the kind of normalized at that time sexual harassment, which didn't even have a name. It wasn't even called sexual harassment.
That's absolutely right. I mean, my thesis advisor was a very distinguished political scientist named Carl Friedrich, and the only trouble with Friedrich as an advisor was he was never there because he was writing post-war constitutions for the countries of Europe. So he turned me over to the tender mercies of one of his graduate students. Again, somebody with bad teeth and body odor, but never mind. And the question of how to escape his clutches and still not jeopardize my summa cum laude degree was absolutely my problem. I mean, there was nobody I could complain to or anything. Or when the interviewer from IBM came to campus interviewing for what IBM called sales engineers, which were really just salespeople who learned enough about computers to be able to pitch them. And these were great jobs. They were well paid, and they hired liberal arts graduates. And I was being interviewed by this man, and we were going great. I mean, I was first in my class, and my name was von Neumann. And then he looked at my left hand and said, "Oh, I see you're engaged." And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Well, I'm sorry, but we have a policy. We don't hire engaged girls." And I was telling this story to my daughter and her best friend right after they graduated. And they said, "And what did you say to him, Mom?" Expecting some really smart put down. And I hesitated, and I said, "Well, actually, what I did was stand up and smooth out my skirt and apologize for taking up his time and left." And of course, they were so disappointed in me. I mean, their faces just fell. And I said, "You know, it's very hard to explain to you the fact that I could have lain on the floor and kicked and screamed, and it wouldn't have made an iota of difference." I mean, he was within his rights. There was no EEOC. If I had gone and complained to the dean, she would have said, "Well, yes, dear, that's unfortunate, but that's how the world is." And I think one of the reasons I wrote, well, there are two reasons I wrote this book. One was to talk about my relationship with my father and how, in a sense, my whole career was propelled by the desire to both meet his expectations and get out from under his shadow. And I've talked to other people who had larger-than-life parents, and everybody had that problem.
Yeah.
And the other reason, which is more relevant to the sexual harassment stuff, is that it seems to me that younger women, even of your generation, and even more of the generation one down, my grandchildren, regard the time period that I'm writing about, the 50s and 60s, as medieval history. And they have no sense of how much things changed over one adult lifetime.
That's right.
And how much work it took to bring about those changes, and in a sense, how fragile those changes are, and that it takes work to maintain them. Well, I think in the current political environment, a lot of people are becoming more and more aware of this fragility. But I really wanted these young people to understand that it hasn't been all that long since women were living in a very different world. And that was sort of the second reason.
Well, and I see you, as I was reading this book, as somebody who protested not by getting out in the street, because that hadn't happened yet, but by being successful.
That's true. And it wasn't just because it hadn't happened yet, because I was still relatively young when feminism started and when the civil rights movement started. And I think it's partly my own personality that I found it much more suited to my own personality to work from the inside out rather than from the outside in. And from time to time, I felt some regret that I wasn't a bit noisier, particularly about the civil rights movement. But the fact is, you know, what's the famous Woody Allen phrase, 90% of life is just showing up? Well, in a sense, I did make my mark by doing what I did rather than by protesting. And I think both were critical, and it's like two halves of the scissors, you know. You need both. But that's absolutely true.
You worked under President Richard Nixon on the Council of Economic Advisors. You were the first woman, you were the youngest person ever in that position. And we'll talk about your work in a second, but again, along the lines of sexism, talk a little bit about the press reception to your appointment.
Yes, people have said to me, you know, did you meet a lot of sexism when you were in the government? And the people who ask me this are usually reporters of one kind or another. And I've answered, partly to bait them, but partly quite truthfully, actually, the only real sexism I met was from the press. I mean, every headline about my appointment was, you know, woman economist appointed to Council of Economic Advisors. And some of them saw fit to comment on my looks. You know, she's certainly the prettiest one they ever had.
And they're still doing
that. Apparently, they're still
doing it. This
still
goes on
it.
In the New York Times and the Washington Post.
I know Hillary Clinton must be a little tired of comments on her hairdo.
Yeah.
And it was the same thing. The Wall Street Journal reporter, when he was reporting on the president's announcement of my appointment, which was already a big PR thing, mentioned the fact that my eyeshadow matched my dress. And, you know, things were absolutely unheard. And even the people who made rather vile comments, and what they were really getting at was Nixon, they put them in a sexual context, which if they had been saying equally nasty things to a man about working for Richard Nixon, they would never have put in that particular context. And I can't even repeat on the radio some of the things that were said in letters which people signed with their names. That's the most astounding thing, that they could say these things and then identify themselves. In other words, they weren't ashamed of what they were saying.
It's funny how some things have gotten better, like nobody would get away with that today. And yet some things have gotten worse, like civility between the parties and among people who don't like each other's opinions in government.
Absolutely. Even though my time in the White House actually ended when I resigned because I could no longer put aside the possibility that the president was involved in the Watergate cover-up. There was still, despite all the things one reads about the enemies list and so forth, there was a kind of civility and certainly a willingness among people in the Senate and the House to work across the aisle. I mean, some of the most progressive legislation we have in the United States today, whether it's OSHA or EEOC or
the EPA,
really came about as a cooperation between Richard Nixon and Daniel Patrick Moynihan, a very prominent Democrat. And it was these two working together, and their failures were as interesting as their successes. They actually tried to put in a negative income tax. They tried to put in something that looks very much universal health insurance. They failed. But the very fact that they tried, and I know that a few years ago, Robert Dole was being interviewed on a public television station, and he commented that Richard Nixon could never get the Republican nomination today. He was far too progressive.
Yeah.
So, and many historians feel, I know, that Watergate itself brought on the beginnings of an era of much greater mutual suspicion and lack of civility and so forth. But it was a very different world.
We're talking to Marina Wittman about her memoir, The Martian's Daughter. You describe, and I think this is very interesting, some of the psychological and cultural barriers that have prevented powerful people in government and industry from seeing what was right in front of them. For example, the adjustment to the fact that the United States was no longer the world's sole superpower as it had been right after World War II. How did this play out in the politics that you witnessed?
Well, actually, this became more important, not as much when I was in government, although I was part of something called the Volcker Commission, committee, I think, headed by Paul Volcker, who was then Undersecretary of the Treasury. And we magnificently redesigned the international monetary system after it fell apart when the U.S. went off the gold exchange standard. And our only problem was that the rest of the world didn't adopt it. So looking back already, that showed there were some limits to what we could get done. But actually, when I became most conscious of people in high places not seeing the nose in front of their face was when I was a senior vice president at General Motors. And here the world, their world, of a very comfortable oligopoly. The big three had more than, I can't remember, but among the three of them, they probably had 70% of U.S. car sales. And when I went to work for GM, people said, congratulations on going to work for Generous Motors. And the world, they believed, was their oyster and was going to stay that way. And it increasingly became clear to me that global competition, and in the case of the auto industry, initially competition from Japanese manufacturers, was here to stay and was only going to get more so.
And interestingly, it was the same issue in government, competition with the Japanese, that they weren't
exactly,
seeing.
Exactly. And I tried and tried, and I wasn't the only one, there were other brave souls too, to make the very top management see that if they continued along the same lines they were going on, disaster lay ahead, and they were going to have to get their heads out of the sand and try to cope with the new realities, which they believed were just transitory and would go away. And so I became kind of the resident Cassandra, foretelling doom and never being believed. And eventually that became so frustrating that I resigned and left. But that really brought home to me the fact that if you insist on believing that the world and your place in it are going to go on as they have been for the last 50 or 100 or whatever years, you may find yourself in very serious trouble. And I remember saying that, you know, General Motors, because I was at GM, and the United Auto Workers are going to join hands and jump off the cliff together. And that's kind of what happened.
It's interesting that it was so much, I mean, as you describe it in your memoir, a really cultural phenomenon. GM had its own culture. The executives had their own culture. They were living in a world that really made it easy for them to keep their heads in the sand.
That's right. They did. They lived in a very protective environment. We were assigned a new GM car every 3 months, and you could sort of have anyone you wanted. I mean, you didn't own it, but you owned the use of it. And if anything went wrong with it, the company fixed it in the company garage, and the top executives had their own dining room. In fact, there were two or three levels of dining rooms. So it was a world in a bubble. And, you know, when the bubble burst, they just were not prepared.
I know that it's impossible to really answer this question, but if GM had made different decisions at that time, how do you think the company and the city of Detroit would have fared?
It would have been different. Now, there were problems that the American companies had that they really couldn't do anything about. For example, they had very high so-called legacy costs, meaning that they had very expensive pension and health care obligations. And as productivity in the industry increased, so that the number of workers to produce a given number of cars shrank, the ratio of retired to active workers went up and up and up. And the Japanese didn't have these legacy costs. In Japan, they didn't have them because both retirement and health care were government issues, not company issues.
Right.
And also, when they started to produce in the United States, first of all, the unions couldn't unionize them, but much more important, they started out with a much younger workforce and no retirees, so that there were certain things which would have made life difficult for the American companies, even if they had done everything right.
One wonders why they didn't lobby for government health care.
Well, they kind of did. Actually, it's interesting. When Jack Smith was chairman, and Jack, by the way, was one of the first chairmen who really tried to get the company to take its head out of the sand. And when Hillary Clinton was presenting, you remember her famous Hillary Care, Jack supported that and actually sat with her at the State of the Union speech or something. And I remember saying to him, Jack, the minute the voting public finds out that this kind of program will benefit the auto companies, they're going to oppose it. Well, certainly that wasn't the only reason that her proposals were opposed. But there's no question that the auto companies would have benefited tremendously, except they believed, and probably they were right, that the union would immediately demand that if GM no longer had to support their health care costs, it would have to give them something equivalent in return. And that was probably realistic. But there's no question. And one of the reasons that production costs were lower for GM in Canada than in the United States, even though Canada has a very strong auto workers union, was because in Canada, health care is a government responsibility and not a company responsibility.
We're talking to Marina Whitman. You worked in government, academia, industry. You worked with a lot of different kinds of people. You worked in public broadcasting and had an economics show. And one of the questions that you asked on this TV show, which I think is a very interesting question, is why do economists disagree?
Right. That, in fact, was our wind-up show after our funding ran out. And besides, I was going to go to work for General Motors, and as a GM executive, I couldn't have run that kind of show. I had Milton Friedman, who everybody's heard of, and Walter Heller, who is less famous, but was probably one of the top economists, advisors to Democratic presidents. And Heller said, well, it's because we have different orders of priority. Some of us are more concerned about free markets, and some of us are more concerned about softening the effects of free markets through some government programs. And Milton Friedman said, oh, no, it's not difference in priorities. It's just that the people like Heller, more on the left, are focused on short-run outcomes, and we, the free market types, are much more focused on long-run outcomes and the impact of the law of unintended consequences. And our final show that we did was a discussion between these two, and it was absolutely fascinating. And in the context of today, where there's always been the joke that the American political spectrum runs all the way from A to B. And for most of our post-war history, it was true that we didn't have an extreme right or an extreme left. And we still don't in the sense of fascism or communism. But I think we have much more separation now. And this brings back to my point about Nixon and his progressivism. We have much wider separation now between those two points of view than we did back when I made that program back in 1978 or 79.
To what extent are economists' views associated with their political parties or not?
To some extent, but not by any means totally. For one thing, almost all economists, and you always have to put a little caveat in there, agree that trade restrictions are a bad thing and reduce general economic welfare. And most economists would agree that if you want to achieve certain goals, it's probably easier to achieve them if you try to work with market forces rather than to buck them. But then, obviously, there are major areas of disagreement. For example, how effective stimulus is, how effective government redistribution of income is, and a whole host of, and you know, what kind and what scope of regulations make sense. So there are lots of issues on which economists do disagree, but there is also a kind of fundamental core of agreement.
The issues that you just mentioned, for example, to what extent stimulus works, redistribution of income, and so on, is there not data that answers those questions?
I wish I could say there was. And there is this sort of joke that goes on saying, you know, everybody is entitled to her or his own opinions, but they're not entitled to their own set of facts. And yet the truth is that people can usually come up with their own set of facts, most of which are not baldly wrong. But it's a question of what basis of measurement you use, what variables you look at,
what you exclude.
Exactly. You know, I mean, there's all this argument about the fact that the population that has access to food stamps has vastly increased. And that's a fact. On the other hand, those on the left say, well, that's because there's been very high unemployment and an awful lot of very low-wage jobs, and wages for lower-income people have stagnated, And people far on the right will say, well, it just shows that more and more of the population is looking for handouts. So, yeah, there's a set of facts there, but you can make very different uses of them.
Right. And in that example, the idea more and more people are looking for handouts, that's not a fact. That's an interpretation.
Exactly. 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 But to be fair, so is the argument that it's due to the stagnation of wages and so forth. That's already an interpretation. Now, you and I may feel it's an interpretation that's closer to the facts than the other one. But in each case, we have moved away from bald facts into interpretation of those facts.
Why do you think that the U.S., with all its great power and might and brain trust and so on, has been so utterly unable to solve the problems of poverty and homelessness?
Oh, that's a hard one. Well, that is really tough. There's some aspects of homelessness where homelessness is due to mental instability or drug use or whatever, which makes it really hard to solve. On the other hand, there are plenty of families or mothers with children who are not mentally ill and they're not drug users, and some of them even have jobs. But for one reason or another, and particularly, of course, during the recent economic recession, lost their homes. And it's not as if the government didn't make any attempt. I mean, there are, you know, affordable housing programs, and there are public housing, and there is a program, although it doesn't turn out to have been very successful, in trying to ameliorate the effect of mortgages being underwater and so forth. Now, of course, it's really hard to get any such thing down to zero. But the fact is that other countries have made more progress than we have. And some of it is the nature of our current politics. Some of it, I think, though, may be further embedded in the American culture. We have, particularly in the Southwest, a much stronger culture of individualism. And it's been part of our country since the beginning of its history. Whereas most European countries, to which we're mainly compared, and certainly Japan, have a much more communitarian view of society. And that it is the society rather than the individual which should be the focus of thinking and of policy. So I think it's both our current economic, our current political divisions, and something deeper ingrained in our culture.
If you were on the Council of Economic Advisors today, what would you recommend?
The main thing I would recommend is that we get our policies about debt reduction straightened out. I mean, right now they're 180 degrees opposite to what they should be. That is, in the short run, we don't really have a deficit problem. Our deficit has dropped from, 6 or 7% of our gross national product to about 3%, partly because of the recession. And we have been cutting spending in the stupidest possible way. We've cut spending on research. We've cut spending on education. We've cut spending on infrastructure. And if we keep doing that, we could end up approaching a third world status.
Yeah.
On the other hand, long run, we surely do have a deficit problem in the sense that if current trends continue, two things, pensions and health care, particularly health care, will eat up a larger and larger proportion of our gross national product. And our deficit will get bigger and bigger in relation to the GNP. So you have the Republicans slashing away at the kind of expenditures I just mentioned, which is only doing the country harm. At the same time, you have the Democrats unwilling to confront the fact that these two big programs, particularly health care, I think it would be pretty easy to solve the Social Security problem. But the health care issue cannot be solved without people getting in some way less than they expect. And that's something, candidly, I have enormous admiration for President Obama, but that's something the Democrats have not been willing to tackle. So you have a situation where we're trying to deal with a sort of non-existent short-run deficit problem and refusing totally to deal with a very real long-run deficit problem. And that's what I guess that's what I would try to disentangle if I were at the CEA. I'm sure they are trying, by the way, but yeah, they can't make themselves heard politically.
What about the billions and trillions spent on war?
Well, at the moment, of course, we're spending rather less on war than we have been in the recent past, because we are clearly winding down. We've wound down our role in the war in Iraq. We are winding down our role in Afghanistan. And the whole problem the president confronts with respect to our behavior towards Syria comes exactly from the lack of appetite on the part of the American people to get involved either in terms of lives or of money in yet another Middle Eastern issue. But certainly in the not too distant past, we were spending a lot of money, and that contributed. But as I say, at the present moment, that is not the big issue, except insofar, as I say, that it confronts the president and the Congress with this kind of issue of there really is no good solution to our role in Syria.
Marina Wittmann is author of the memoir, The Martian's Daughter. She's the daughter of mathematician John von Neumann. She's professor of business administration and public policy at the University of Michigan. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
I really enjoyed it. Thanks so much, Mary Charlotte, for having me.